Hello and welcome to Leave Your Mark. I'm your host, Scott Livingston, and this is where I explore the influences that have shaped the lives of our incredible guests. These are the stories of lives worth talking about. Follow me on Twitter at Built by Scott and Instagram at King O'Payne, or link up with me on my Facebook fan page, Scott G. Livingston. My goal is to empower and inspire a community of people who take every opportunity to live a high-performing life.
Our key sponsor, Vald, is fast becoming one of the key innovators in human performance. They provide practitioners with a wide range of technologies for measuring, monitoring, and improving musculoskeletal health. And they are trusted by thousands of clinics, hospitals, sporting teams, and defense departments around the world. Vald has objective measurement solutions for you. The Dynamo handheld dynamometer and inclinometer, force decks, dual force plates, force frame strength testing, human track movement analysis system, and Norbor hamstring testing system. Together, they are capable of measuring and monitoring almost every major function of musculoskeletal and movement health. If you're looking to take your performance game to another level, Vald can help you become an objectively informed practitioner. Visit www.vald.com today for more information on their complete line of products. The two most expensive things in life are following bad advice and breakdowns in communication. The Art of Coaching Apprenticeship course gives you the tools and strategies necessary to navigate tough conversations, better understand human behavior, and improve your ability to think on the spot. Whether you're a people pleaser who struggles with hard conversations, someone who wants to be better at negotiating, or you simply want to improve your ability to think on your feet, the apprenticeship can help. It's 2 days, highly interactive, and allows you to get feedback that will help you in every aspect of your personal and professional life. I participated in this course, and I know through my own experience that it's going to change the way you communicate, participate, and lead in life. On June 22nd and 23rd of this year, the Art of Coaching Apprenticeship is coming to Calgary, Alberta. And if you are a Leave Your Mark listener, you can benefit from $100 off the registration price of this important and powerful course using the coupon code LYMAOC, all in caps. Head over to artofcoaching.com today and register. Do you find yourself challenged to bring all your disparate skills and tools together to create more effective client solutions? Are you challenged to play in the gray area between injury and performance when injuries keep coming back or performance issues keep reoccurring? Are you seeing what's happening in neuroscience today and wondering how to bring it into your practice? Neuroreconditioning is an operating system for bringing the worlds of therapy and performance together under the overreaching lens of applied neurology. So many of the professionals who've begun their reconditioning journey remark how it just brings everything they've ever learned together, helping them make better technical and tactical decisions, and in turn getting better and longer lasting results. Neuroreconditioning is a three-step process that begins with our signature course, R1 Foundations, where you'll learn how to assess movement, understand the drivers of pain and performance issues, and provide interventions to the neurological system, and integrate your own approach and practice so it works for you, in your environment, and with your clients. Head over to reconditioninghq.com and get your free download and start making a difference for your clients today. We've taken care of those that take care of us. On to the podcast. Hello and welcome to Leave Your Mark. I'm your host, Scott Livingston, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Joel Gandara. Joel is a personal life coach who brings a compelling personal narrative that resonates with a wide audience. His journey from a poor immigrant to successful entrepreneur is a testament to resilience and determination. Joel is a Cuban immigrant to the U.S. who grew up in a family with very little means. He found a way to transcend poverty and explore
entrepreneurship, building numerous highly successful businesses. His story of achieving the American dream is an inspiration. As a thought leader in personal growth and success, Joel offers valuable insights and practical advice. His philosophy is outlined in his book, 31 Days to Become a Better Man, and his strategy for managing stress and avoiding burnout can provide people with actionable strategies to create their own success. He's been married to his best friend, Jessica, for 21 years, and together they have 4 children. I am pleased to have him on the show today. Welcome, Joel.
Awesome. Thank you, Scott. Happy to be here with you.
Anybody who has 4 kids should be on a podcast and should be talking about their life journey. That in and of itself is a life journey.
That's a whole series. Yeah. Especially mine range from the age of 18 down to 9. So we've already started experience all kinds of stuff. And it's with my same wife. We just had 2 and thought that was it. She was busy as a registered nurse and working overnights in labor and delivery. And then my business started doing better and she was able to stop working. So we said, hey, do you want to have more kids? Sure. And we agreed that 4 was a good number. And you know, so the experiences are 1 in elementary, 1 in middle school, and 2 who are in their final year of high school. But interestingly enough, this last summer, the oldest of them turned 18, and he turned 18 at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. It's a military base where he was completing basic training with the Army. He's now an American soldier as a senior in high school. He's an American soldier with a sharpshooter badge on his chest. And I got to be there at graduation and take, he was one of about 10 of 180 who got a promotion while they were there. The sharpshooter badge is one thing, but he got a promotion. I got to be the one who went up, took his rank off of him and put the new rank.
Wow.
And now he graduates, he finishes ROTC, you know, JROTC in the high school. So he's going to rank up again and be, I think, an E3 in the Army. That's a good start.
Wow. Very cool story. I love that already. That's a great way to start. I mean, when you have 4 kids, I have a friend of mine that has 4. The early part of it with all the diapers and all the little ones and everything can be no doubt challenging. But once they get a little older, they all kind of take care of one another. And I guess you're probably at that place right now where they kind of, you don't even have to watch over them as much as they watch over each other as brothers and sisters and stuff.
That's right. That's right. Man, when you cross that line, anybody who's still carrying the diaper bag, I promise it gets better.
Well, let's go back. You obviously, you know, I'm kind of curious about the story of you coming to America, so to speak. You're a Cuban immigrant, and in the bio that I read about you, you literally did a boat ride across the water to Florida. I mean, I don't know how old you were then, but what do you remember about that, and what, or do you even remember that?
Yeah, I remember, and I remember to the point where, you know, when there's an emotion tied to a memory, it really solidifies itself. And if it's a great emotion, it's a beautiful memory that you could carry for life. When it's a scary, traumatic emotion, it gets ingrained. I don't have any tattoos on my body, but I definitely got some in my brain. And that's one that's tattooed. It's scarred in deep. And if I was 4.5 years old, I'm not that smart, but I have a really good memory. Proven by the things I've told my parents over many years. And they go, yeah, that's exactly how it went down. You know, so I have a good memory, but it really helps that this was a little bit traumatic. We were sent to, in 1980, Cuba had the Mariel boat lifts. President Jimmy Carter allowed a lot of people to come here for humanitarian purposes. Fidel Castro is very smart. He's evil, but he was smart. He emptied the prisons and this insane asylums and filled the boats with a few families and a lot of men. Weird looking men who are criminals, who are crazy. And that's how he got rid of his problems. By the way, he did not let political prisoners who didn't agree with him go. He let the common thieves and the, you know, the riffraff go. So we came, 125,000 of us in multiple boats. A lot of those boats actually sank. They were overcrowded. Ours, my dad says that he saw a capacity sign of about 75, and we were easily double that. So we were stacked in. There weren't enough life vests. We stayed in a location at the dock for about 2 days before we left. There was no food. Then we got on these boats. And it was traumatic in that I remember as a kid, you know, my parents remember it one way. I might remember a little bit different. For me, it was the emotion of those soldiers. They were just angry and they were yelling. And I remember thinking, what are they doing this to us for? Finally, we got on that boat and we sat in there for a few hours before they gave the all clear. My guess is just to be jerks, because what did they care if we just leave now? We're leaving 2 hours. But they wanted us sitting there to show their dominance over us. We got out, and we didn't make it to Key West, Florida for 12 hours. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is because 4 of those hours, there was a very strong storm. That's the part that is locked in my head. And when I say a very strong storm, when that boat would go up, I remember looking around, and you were in the sky. And when that roller coaster ride would drop, this is 3 to 4 hours of this. It was 4 walls of water. You looked all around, there you couldn't see the top. It was just, and then back up. And then, you know, if you've been to that area, you know, the Straits of Florida, it gets rough. It's a Caribbean area, and the storms are tough. You know, when you said I came on a boat over here, a boat ride, I've been on many boat rides, and they've been beautiful. I went fishing recently, and we caught sailfish, and we caught all kinds of fish, sport fishing. That's fun. And a little rocky sea, that's cool. But this was traumatic. But I do have a memory of pulling into Key West, and it was just as smooth a ride as you could imagine in that naval base. I remember a long cement dock on the left. By the way, this year I Googled it and I found it. I saw that long cement dock that's still there, or at least the pictures are still there, of what I pulled into. And there were volunteers there giving us soup and chocolate and Coca-Cola and just any energy that we could digest. And then another soldier was there. This was a Black American soldier, but he was smiling. And he said, "Welcome to America. Welcome to freedom." And he helped everybody. Oh, and I hear that myself saying, and I get goosebumps, because what a difference from a dictatorship treating us like animals to just welcoming us and giving us food. And wow. Yeah, that was my journey just to get here.
As an adult, man, have you ever sat and chatted with your dad about like how difficult that decision was to make and how scared he was about bringing his family across on that boat that day? Like, that was a huge risk on his part, or and your parents' part. I mean, I don't mean to delete your mom from that decision at all, you know?
Yeah, that's actually where I'll take it. It was my mom. So it was my mom, my dad, my brother, and myself. My dad's not a big risk taker, but he was sentenced at 17 years old to cut sugarcane, mandatory labor camp, 3-year sentence. And it was either military or that, but that's what they told him he's going to go do. And so, you know, he's gone through some stuff, my dad. And after 6 months of being in that labor camp, he was dying of malnutrition, and they sent him home. By then, his parents had an opportunity to flee the country with his brothers and sisters, and they were gone. So from the age of 17 to 30, my dad was alone. By then, he had a wife, and he had my brother and I. So my dad had had enough. You know, he'd been put through a grinder there. And then, I'll tell you this, 3 years ago, the Telemundo Network did a special on the 40-year Mariel boat lifts. And so they've heard about me. I've had a little bit of press. I didn't look for it, but I built some businesses, and everybody has written, or they've written some things about, well, from a Mariel boat lift person to successful entrepreneur, right? So I got contacted by Telemundo, the Spanish radio station, our TV station here in Miami. And they said, "We heard about you. We read an article about you. And we have this 40th anniversary. We'd like to talk about you and come send reporters and come do a whole story." Well, they sent whatever the prize winner, whatever the news people get. This lady had won multiple prizes, the top prize for journalists. She's awesome. I've stayed in touch with her. I've been on more of her shows since then. So the reason this is important is when they talked to me, they said, "You've got a fascinating story. What about your parents?" And I said, "Their story." And they said, "Can we do something? We want to knock out 2-day segments while we're at your house. We want to talk to your parents." So I put them in touch. They agreed it was a good story too. And they had my parents in my living room recording, let's call it day 20, because they did like maybe 40 days of every night was a certain family's thing. And they did a morning piece and a night piece, but that day was my parents' piece. And when they were recording it, here we have a whole crew in my living room. And I see my mom and my dad being interviewed, and I'm behind the camera watching them being interviewed. And I figure it's all going to be the stories I've been hearing for the last 40 years. And it wasn't. I got to hear the inside of my mom's brain, not just the stories she normally tells me. My mom's a very strong person, very physically strong, mentally one of the strongest people I know. But man, she opened up. Mm-hmm. And she said, as we were in that sea and that storm was, you know, holding both of my sons and rocking and you know, it felt like we're going to go overboard and like the boat was breaking and we're getting drained on for 3 to 4 hours. She said all she could do was cry and ask God for forgiveness because she brought her two little boys to the ocean to die because we were about to die. Mm-hmm. And she's saying this crying, and I had to leave. I couldn't even be there. I had to go to another part of the house. And so, yeah, I've heard all the stories from my parents, but that was the most impactful one, hearing my mom crying and saying that she knew that in the next few minutes we were all going to die and there was no life jackets. And I don't know if a life jacket would have helped in those seas. We would have drowned. You know, as a kid, that was scary. It was traumatic, and I'm still scared of the ocean. But hearing it as an adult now, it's a new trauma. And I'm not a psychologist. I haven't seen one about this. But so was my brother. We would have all drowned. It's pretty sad. And I know who lost family members during that journey, both before us or after us. And they lost their. So to hear from my mom that perspective, which before my mom and dad would tell stories to friends and family and to myself, I grew up listening to a lot of stories, but never from this perspective of what was going on in my mom's mind. Mm. The fear that here she brought her two little boys, all she's got, to the middle of the ocean to have us drown there, because she was convinced that in the next few minutes we were going to drown.
Hmm. What, like, I think the value, there's a huge value proposition in interviewing somebody like yourself with this background, because not every person in North America or in any country has an immigrant experience. And I think sometimes people don't recognize or understand what goes on to create an immigrant experience. And sometimes we don't have the empathy for what that is. And I'm also curious to unpack a little bit when you see, because I feel in my lifetime, which I'm a little older than you, but in general, we feel a parallel the same timing. And it seems like there was greater acceptance in the United States. And you were talking about it earlier, just in your experience when you landed, of the American dream, in the sense that people were welcomed to America because they were immigrating there. And now it seems almost as though that's not the same case. And so describe the immigrant experience. Like, what are you feeling? Like, I know you can't really describe it in a sense because you were so young, but then you grew up as that and your parents described it. It's this sense that there is something better that I am going to, but I am taking a risk that I can navigate it. And I'm just curious, what's the internal language around that? And how do you feel about it when it's happened to you in some sense?
Yeah. So when I got here, I immediately got dropped in. We got here in June. In September, I started school. Mm. That was very rough for me. That was a tough transition because I didn't understand one word that was said that entire year. I really don't think I learned any English. Maybe I did, like the beginning stages, like, you know, my brain started coming so that the next year I understood half of what was said. And the next year I really started getting it.
Mm.
But it was rough. I personally, I don't think it was out of malice of anyone, but I felt like a loser. I felt dumb. I remember going home and telling my mom how stupid all the kids were, because I was just angry because no one understood me. And I'd sit there alone in the playground and I couldn't play with anybody. And they'd say things and it was like they're just saying gibberish. So those type of things were frustrating. But I got it faster than my parents. Of course, they were in their 30s, and it's harder to learn a language at that age. My brother and I picked it up much quicker. You know, we got made fun of. We kids would make fun of you if you didn't speak right. You'd say something, and they'd, aha, you said this. That's not how you say it. I remember going to a Kentucky Fried Chicken in the early 80s, and my dad, you know, I guess I was a better speaker of English than my parents. So they said, go over there and ask them. They didn't give us the mashed potatoes, the little bucket of mashed potatoes. So I go up there. Obviously, my parents have only spoken to me in Spanish my whole life. So they say that. And I walk up and interpret it in my head the best I could. And I said, one squash potato. Because I thought squashed, you know, squished, mashed. I didn't remember the word. And I remember that the girl was like, what? And I repeated it. And she goes, what? And then another girl came. And I remember both of their faces like, what? What? As if I said the craziest thing. I think back, I go, that wasn't that bad. But then again, I didn't grow up in South Florida where if I would have, first of all the employees would speak Spanish. I grew up in San Francisco is where we ended up growing up. And apparently they didn't understand my English. So that, there was a transition there. So there was a couple things going on. I grew up very poor. Mm. So there was that. I was different. I didn't speak the language. I come from a hot climate. Here I'm wearing jackets and a hat and it's freezing in San Francisco compared to Cuba. And my language, yeah. So the language, the money, everything was a little bit different. At school, kids would wear better brands. I would wear the cheapest shoes that were no names. And my pants were given to us maybe from some friends or a church, and they were used, and you can see the hem lines at the bottom, and you can see that they've been worn by a lot of kids. So there's some of that. Those are the things that, for good or bad, those are some of the impactful things that I think I take from mm-hmm. time.
How did you end up in San Francisco? Why there?
1967, when my grandparents left the country, Miami wasn't as developed as it is today, obviously, and they had the godfather of my aunt. Had found a job at a factory in San Francisco. So when they got here, my grandfather, he was a police officer in Havana. Once communism took over and he saw abuses of justice, he quit and became a mechanic. So when he got to California, he became a maintenance man in a lighting factory for 30 something years, getting up at 3:30 every morning and turning on the machines and oiling them. And that's where home base was, because that's where my grandparents, uncles, aunts. So in one day in June of 1980, I met four uncles and aunts, plus their spouses, plus a bunch of first cousins and my grandparents. And yeah, so that's where that all happened in California.
Wow. You grew up, obviously, with work ethic as a central core thematic of your life. How did that, did you fight that or did you just embrace that? Like, because most kids, like, I don't want to work, Ma, or I don't want to do that or whatever. Like what, you know, was that something you fought or you just embraced and dove into? And it sounds like you, the latter, but I'm kind of curious how that went for you early on.
It never even occurred to me that that was an option until you just said that right now. All I ever wanted to do was work. I was always looking for a job when I was a kid. And I got the first opportunity at 12 years old at Stanford University, American football games. And my school had a program where you, especially if you see my dad and mom got a job at a little Christian radio station, not for profit. And that paid a large portion of this Christian school. They paid it, the school. They didn't pay them much, but they would pay for tuition if you took them to a Christian school. So this is after a couple of years of public school. And then the school negotiated with my dad to only pay like, it was ridiculous. I remember sending the check in on the first of the month. I'd walk in. It was like $100 a month that they would charge my dad. But anytime there was an opportunity for clean up the school, I had to be there because that was the kid who was going in for free, basically. So we'd Stanford University to pay for uniforms and or athletics and things like that. You would go there and sell chocolate malts, these chocolate ice creams with a wooden spoon, Carnation brand. And you'd walk up and down the aisle saying, chocolate malts here. For a dollar. And that to me was heaven because I got to handle money. I got to learn. They paid you a tiny commission. You'd walk out of there with a few bucks per box that you would sell. But I sold a lot. In fact, I remember I did that from 12 to 16. I did it for 4-ish seasons. And as it got more lucrative, as I got older, they raised the commission. They made it like a real job. I also was now 16. I could carry two boxes at a time and I could run up and down those stairs better. And my proudest moments were the times that I won total sales for the stadium. And I did that multiple times because I loved to work and I knew I was there to work because I wanted to make money. And that what would happen is I can tell you this, in all those seasons, I never watched one play of football. I never looked back and said, oh, there's a game there. As much as I would have wanted to, I always felt like I'm here for a reason right now today, and it's to work and take home as much money as I could because my parents could never buy me things other than food and a roof. So, and clothes and the basic. So if I wanted to do something fun, if I wanted to buy myself a toy, I had to have that money on my own. So yeah, I was ready to work and have worked since I was 12 years old.
You can correct me, but it sounds like your parents worked
for a living their entire lives, in a sense of not having a choice or an ability to define the passion of that experience. And I'm kind of curious, when did you convert from I work to I explore something that's passionately innate to me in some sense? What, you know, differentiate that for me, if you understand where I'm coming from.
Yeah, sense. Well, that's, I have an idea. Today I went to see a speaker of the book, The Introvert's Edge, a phenomenal book that I read years ago. And today I got to meet him, Michael Pollard, and speak to him. And during his talk and breakout sessions, I got to speak to some other people. And he talks about passion and finding your passion and working in your passion, how you'll do much better in life. This is interesting. I thought that my passion, initially, my driver was to get out of the ghetto, because I grew up right outside of Oakland, California, very rough neighborhood. Things happened all the time, breaking into homes, cars, shootings. I know multiple people that got killed when I was a kid. And I know multiple people, three people that killed and are in prison for life that I went to high school with. I went to a very rough high school. Wow. So my motivation, my passion, all my existence was get out of here. This isn't me. I don't want to grow up here. My parents weren't like that. And so, once I got out of there, I still was working really hard. I'd have multiple jobs, but I always knew that entrepreneurship was my passion. I want to build something. I want to be the master of my own destiny. I want to make something with my hands. I don't want to just clock in and have a 9-to-5 and, oh, great, I got an extra 4 hours of overtime today and I did a 12-hour shift. There's got to be more to it than that. Mm-hmm. And I had some jobs. I mean, I had a job where I took a piece of paper that people hand wrote there to get medical benefits with a private health care company, and I'd have to type it in. So I just read a piece. This is what I did for 8 hours a day. It's as close, I think, as I've ever gotten to wanting to jump out of that building. I was up on the 20th floor. It was depressing. So my passion at that point was to find something to replace what I'm doing. And then after I started building a business, again, not knowing what I was doing, but I started building it. I started hiring people. I got a warehouse. I developed my own brand of clothing. I mean, all these things started happening. I bought 14 of my competitors and I thought, this is great. And then I started realizing none of that was really my passion. What could be my passion? I don't actually love that. It served its purpose. It got me out of bad situation. My kids will never have to know what that was like. But then now at 47 years old, I discovered my passion. I'm a different person over the last year, because even though I've been coaching entrepreneurs and executives for almost 10 years as like a side thing that I was doing along with my business, I now sold that business and I'm out of it. So now I started coaching primarily guys, and I even wrote a book called 31 Days to Become a Better Man. And I'm seeing the results. And now I realize that's my passion. It's to show, in my case, I show guys, you know, my wife's building a program out of necessity, out of so many people asking for women. And we're going to work on that together and do retreats and all that sort of thing. But this is my passion. It's to help people who, a lot of the time, they know what to do. They know how to be a great dad. They know how to be a great husband, a great citizen, but they forget. And they just put their head down and go 9-to-5, and they're not very intentional about their life. So for me, at 47 years old, I'm happy to say I discovered my passion, and it's helping guys to become better in their life so that then they can help others become better. And it's working. I've had over 200 guys just this year go through the program already and graduate and tell me that their lives have changed. But the most impactful statements are when I meet their wives and they say, I want to thank you. Those 31 days that my husband was in that class with you, and that made him a new person. And my kids have noticed, I've noticed. So that, like, yeah, I don't know how else to say that. I found my passion, and that's what really moves me. And that's what I'm going to do for the rest of my life.
Wow. When you look back on what your parents experienced, feeling you have for them, maybe not having ever experienced what you just talked about, that they just worked in order to make sure you guys were okay, kind of thing.
Yeah. My parents had us live a very simple life, but they were very responsible. Those go hand in hand. I think we never went on vacations. I mean, it would, the cheapest motel you can imagine, maybe once every few years, we went a couple of nights somewhere. And usually it was because someone who my dad met would say, hey, I've got a cabin, go use it. You know, it was things like that for two nights. So we lived a very simple life, a very sheltered life in that sense. And my parents, continue to live that way. It's just in them. It's the way they are. I'm still scared to tell my dad sometimes like what things cost me because they just can't imagine. You know, I typically for the last 20 years would make in a month what my parents would make in 2 years as an income. And sure, there's inflation in there, but still, I mean, they had it kind of rough. So whenever I can, whenever they're up to it, I invite them on vacations and bring them with me and bring them over to my house as much as I can, as much as they want to. I invite all the time. So, yeah, they did not get to be on the other side of that. But my dad is also the first to say that it wasn't just because he got here in his 30s, because we know people who got here in their 30s and 40s and have built some pretty amazing businesses. My dad's the first to say, I wasn't a risk taker. I've never been a risk taker. My dad would tell me, in fact, make some money and kind of hide it under the mattress and don't shoot too high, you know, keep it tight and small and just make a couple dollars and put it away. So, that's how my dad has lived his life. I understand a lot of that's out of necessity. Look, my dad, because of the things he went through in that labor camp in Cuba, cutting sugarcane, and sometimes his dinner after all day in the sun was a glass of water with a piece of sugarcane in it that he cut, you know, so I know what he's been through. So my dad till this day will find a nail on the ground as we're walking down the sidewalk and he'll pick it up and go, it's a little bent, but I'll bang it back into shape. So that's my parents' life. It's had to be just work. Put your head down and save as much as you can. My dad still bathes in the shower and has a bucket there always. And that bucket is to catch anything that falls because he uses that for the plants. And that's just, he'll never let go of that. He has to be that way. And by the way, I'm not criticizing him. Yeah. I learned a lot of good discipline with money. And at 22 years old, this kid making $10 an hour, me, growing up in a bad neighborhood, I saved up $32,000 and I bought my first house at 22 years old in California. And I did that through working two full-time jobs, saving all the money, because that's what my parents taught me to do.
What do you think informed you at that age in this rough neighborhood not to go the wrong way, but to go a better way?
I did go the wrong way. I had some incidents. When I was 17 days after I turned 18, I got arrested for stealing shoes from a department store where I was working at. I was in high school and I just needed money. I wanted to have an inexpensive car. I wasn't shooting for the moon, an inexpensive car, but I had to pay the insurance. I had to pay the gas. By the way, there's no excuse. I shouldn't have done it, but I know why I did it in my mind. You know, I needed, and none of it was to show off or buy jewelry or be fancy. It was to live a little better. And I didn't know. That's the problem. That desire is okay. Problem is no guidance. This is the reason I've mentored so many young people for free. Because if I see a hope and they're in a bad situation, if I can help them, I'll do that. Because all I knew was the most successful guy down the street was a drug dealer. And not because I think he was a drug dealer, because I saw him do drug deals. And I saw the crack cocaine when he would put it in a bush and you're walking by and you look away so he doesn't kill you. And he broke into my car and stole stuff, and or his crackhead clients did, so they can buy his cocaine. So when you don't have that guidance, you do make these stupid mistakes. And then I said, okay, I'm never going to do that again. How else can I make money? I had a couple thousand dollars in the bank. I was still in high school and I started loaning money because somebody said to me, loan me $500. I'll pay you back $550 over the next 3 months or whatever it was. And he did. And I told another friend and he said, oh, give me those same terms. I'll do it too. I did that one. And then somebody didn't pay me. Mm-hmm. And I went with a friend and we showed up at that guy's work and my friend broke his car window to pay him back, like to show him. And then we got arrested. Now I was 18 or 19 at that point. And that's when I said, okay, something's got to change. I can't keep doing this. This isn't who I am. I'm not a bad kid. And I remember a bailiff in the court looked at me on that second time. And I guess he could tell I probably wasn't a bad kid. And he came over to me and goes, kid, go home and listen to your mom. This isn't you. Don't be like that. And that man, he hit me. I was like, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. My parents are very ethical people. They don't do things like that. And that's when I said, that's it. That's it. I'm not going that way anymore.
Wow.
You probably didn't expect that.
No, but it's a great, I love the vulnerability. I'm sure the listener is going to value that because some people don't talk about those kinds of things, but I think it's how you grow, you know. Obviously, you built a lot of different businesses and created things. What did you learn about entrepreneurship that you can sort of provide to the listener? You know, what are sort of your big rocks of entrepreneurship that maybe sometimes people don't think about when they dive into business or create a business for themselves that you found created success for you.
Quick break here. We'll be back to the podcast in just a minute. I want to help Vald spread their message and mission to help performance professionals do their best work and serve their clients most effectively. Vald is all about providing practitioners around the world with a range of technologies for measuring, monitoring, and improving musculoskeletal health. They offer a wide variety of testing solutions for you and your practice to deliver valuable, objective measures. Along with helping you measure just about anything you might need to know about performance, Vald also offers a wide range of completely free digital health solutions, granting you easy access to powerful, engaging digital tools for every step of your clinical treatment pathway. Visit www.vald.com for more information today. If you're someone who pushes yourself relentlessly, craves feedback, and will do anything to grow, then you'll love the Art of Coaching Apprenticeship. This two-day course offers an intensive deep dive into all things communication and psychology. Taken together, you'll gain the skills necessary to navigate conflict, get out of your own head, and improve your ability to build lasting buy-in with others. True growth is a matter of you versus you. The Art of Coaching Apprenticeship provides you with communication strategies, opportunities to practice, and the framework you need to overcome anxiety, help you quit overthinking, and improve your ability to have tough conversations. On June 22nd and 23rd, the Art of Coaching Apprenticeship is coming to Calgary, Alberta. If you are a Leave Your Mark listener, you can benefit from $100 off the registration price of this important and powerful course using the coupon code LYMAOC, all in caps. Head over to artofcoaching.com today and register. Nothing is more frustrating than a client that keeps coming back with the same injury or performance issue. It's frustrating for the client, and it's challenging for you, the practitioner. At reconditioninghq.com, we know you want to make the difference. You want to be able to use all the skills and knowledge you've acquired to find the solutions. But we also know it can be challenging to bring all the skills, tools, and knowledge acquired through different information sources together in a cohesive and systematic approach that creates high-impact results. That's why we started teaching neural reconditioning to help you bring all of the power you possess together in one powerful approach under the lens of applied neurology. Once you begin to practice neural reconditioning, you'll wonder why you waited so long to get started. And getting started begins with our signature course, R1 Foundations. For more information on how to level up your practice starting now, head over to reconditioninghq.com for your free download today. Now, let's get back to our podcast.
Yeah, it's all common sense. There's not going to be any secrets or tips. You know, I coach people, and I think sometimes they want me to give them complicated words and a word salad and confuse them. None of that. It's all common sense. It's all the stuff you learned in elementary school. So, but you got to remember to do it. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. For me, a couple of things. I want to deliver value to people all of the time. And I did that. I built a little business where it grew and I bought 14 of my competitors and then I sold it off. But when I was starting in a little spare bedroom in my condo, people would place orders first on eBay. And then I went to trade shows and started selling to stores. And I realized something. I wanted to make my customers really happy, but I didn't want them to have high expectations. I wanted to lower their expectations and then wow them. And this paid itself off so well, because if I said, hey, thank you for your order, whether it was an eBay order or on a website or wholesale to stores, I would say, thank you for your order. We received it. Give us a couple of days and it will be sent out. Yeah, right. That's the only time I would lie to my customers. It's going out right now. I'm going to package this up and I'm running to the post office where I was going 6 days a week. Back then, they didn't have label printers and I couldn't buy the postage. So I had to go stand in line for 30 minutes a day at the post office to do this. But I did it. Sometimes I'd go twice because I just wanted to wow the customer so much. And I'd go there with 20, 30 packages a day. Eventually, obviously, that grew. I had to get a warehouse. I had to get employees and run a real business. But delivering, over delivering, you know, under promising, I think is a good trait. I think we do the opposite in our lives sometimes. Instagram and Facebook, and people have these fancy lives on the outside. Sometimes you get to know that person and they've done the opposite, and it's a bait and switch, and it's not right. You know, guys can complain about women and say, well, when I met my girlfriend, she was this way, and then I got married to her, and after a few years, she went downhill and did this, this, and this. Yeah, but look at yourself. You probably didn't tell her that you were going to sit on the couch and drink beer all day and not go take care of the lawn and not be a pleasant person and not take your wife out to eat. And I can make a long list because I hear guys complain about their wives a lot. And I get it. Maybe they deserve a little bit of that. But you have to look at yourself as a guy, and vice versa. Everybody has to look at themselves and say, wait a minute, I overpromised. I promised a bag of goods here that's not happening. I know someone who on social media puts pictures with his six-figure cost car, right? This is like a $200,000 car, but yet says, I don't know why I can't meet any good girls. I just keep getting gold diggers that want my money. Well, stop having a $100,000 watch and a $200,000 car and showing it off constantly, and then you won't attract that type of person. My wife isn't attracted to those things, and guess what? I don't even own a watch. I don't own rings or jewelry, and so I'd have never attracted that sort of woman, right, in my life or friends. So, so yeah, over-deliver. Honestly, I know in the beginning money is the most important thing when you're building a business. But if you could just have this philosophy of, okay, I'm not going to do transactions where I lose money because I cannot buy this cup for a dollar and sell it to you for 50 cents. I can only do that so much and then I run out of money. But if I know that I buy it for a dollar and I can sell it to you for $2 and cover the shipping costs and all of that, every time I got an order, I fought the urge from stores. You know, they'd place a 500-piece order, a 200-piece order as I'm starting my business. I never did the math to see how much I earned on that, because I felt like I was being very transactional and very cheap. I knew that there was money to be made. You ordered 500 pieces from me and they cost you $10 each. I know that's about $5,000. I know that probably cost me $2,500. And boom, sure, I made $2,500. That's an easy one because the numbers are easy. But I remember in the beginning calculating, I go, whoa, I just made $1,000 today on this order, blah, blah, blah. Well, after a while, I said, let me not worry about that. Let me not have my brain go to that. Instead, let me worry about, instead of taking those 2 seconds to calculate it, let me respond back to the client, say, hey, your order is going to go out in the next couple of days, and let me go run out to the warehouse and package it up and make sure FedEx takes it today. And so those are some of the things, just not over-promising, but over-delivering, and not worrying about the money. Do the right thing, and I think the money will be there in the end.
Mm, nice. I like that. So you keep mentioning this lady named Jessica. Tell me about her. How did you meet her, and how does she become your best friend?
So it's funny. I don't think I have any boring stories. I mean, they might be boring. I think they're all exciting. my wife, I met her on America Online when the internet was brand new. And I mean, I was 2 days into the internet. That's how soon I met her on the internet. But here's the crazy part. I was in San Francisco and she was in Miami, and I entered into an America Online Miami chat room. Being that I was born in Cuba, I knew one day I'd end up living here in South Florida, and I ended up doing that. So I said, let me see if I meet a Cuban girl. I've never met one. And this is before the internet, so there's no way of finding people. You just know who's in your neighborhood. And I go into this Miami chat room and people say, you know, gender, location, but I didn't know her age. And she says something. And then I instant message with her. Today it's called the DM, this direct message. And I start chatting with her. And we're about 10 minutes in. And I go, this girl seems so nice. And I said, hey, how old are you? And she says, 15. And I go, ah. Okay, I have a cousin very close in age. You guys are about a year and a half apart. I'm going to introduce you guys because I am 21 and that's very weird. So here's my cousin. I introduced them. They became pen pals. For years, they wrote each other letters and sent them in the mail. They're just two kids. And a lot of coincidences happened. A few months later, I visited Miami. I didn't visit her, obviously. A year later, I visit Miami, but I take that cousin of mine and he says, let's meet up with Jessica. She'll bring a friend. We'll all go to dinner. And we did. But I felt weird because they were younger than me. They were all 16, 17. I was 22 at the time. 2 years later, I moved to Miami. I lived 10 blocks from her, no communication. And then I moved back to California. And right when I do, my cousin says, that's funny. You're single right now at the same moment that my friend Jessica just broke up with her boyfriend. You should get in touch with her. She's 19. I was 25. That's not as weird. And he puts us in touch. 6 months later, I'm moving back to Miami. 6 months after that, we're engaged. 6 months later, we're married. And now it's been 21 years, 4 kids. And we just keep saying, like, this is a one in a multi-billion coincidence or craziness that we got together and that we're actually soulmates and like absolute best friends. My wife walks into the room. Like, let's say we finish here and she'll walk in here. It puts a big smile on my face, even if I spent 8 hours with her today. I just haven't seen her in the last 20 minutes. And she walks in. I don't know what it is. I don't know that I have that effect on her, but I think she thinks I'm okay. So, yeah, we got a pretty neat bond.
What does she balance in you?
Oh, we went on a couples retreat in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, in the mountains, in an all-inclusive, beautiful horse ranch right before COVID. You know, 16 entrepreneurial couples from all around the world. And they did our personality indexes, and then they graphed them and made them beautiful in color and put them up. And then a lot of similarities in couples, but then they put one of them up and it was all red and intense. And the other one was all blue and soft, and everybody laughed and they go, this is the weirdest couple. And everybody had them. Who do you guys think it is? And everybody looked around and they said, Joel and Jessica. And they were absolutely right. I'm the high intensity type A, ADHD, a million miles an hour. And she's the calm, just like no stress. That's her. That's absolutely her. And that's what she brings in me. She reminds me all the time how much better a human I am nowadays. Because when I was in my 20s, I'd get road rage if somebody cut me off. I didn't look for problems. But if you cut me off, I may pull up to you, lower my window, yell a few things and say, let's pull over, because I wanted to fight them. Ironically, I didn't even know how to fight. Now I train Brazilian jiu-jitsu and I might be able to fight better, but I definitely don't want to fight anybody unless they're my training partners. So she brings that calm and peace in my life. And I don't know if my kids would be alive if I didn't have her, because I would have done crazy, risky things with them and they could have fallen off a roof, but she keeps the calm and everything safe.
What created that change in you when you look back on the guy you were and the guy you are now? Was that intentional or organic, or what was the shift?
So there has to be, I mean, I check my testosterone levels regularly. They're still there. So it's not like I got real soft or anything. I still work out and I'm still intense, but she's made me realize that that was stupid. That was misdirected. How are you going to go get in a fight with a stranger? What if he pulls out a machete or a gun or a shotgun? I mean, he'll kill you. That's stupid. Why would you do that? And it was definitely work. It's talking to my wife. I did speak one time to a counselor who told me, wasn't a psychiatrist, but just a counselor. And he said something to me that impacted me in one visit. His name was John Gallagher. And this was about 20 years ago. And he said, you know, when someone cuts you off in traffic and that gets you worked up, you start thinking negative thoughts. So then an opportunity comes up, a chance to say hello to a friend, but you greet them kind of grumpy. And now you're going down a vicious cycle of ruining your life. Why don't you just, when that person cuts you off, carry a little pad of paper. And I did this. This is before cell phones, you know, these smartphones. So I wrote down what happened. This guy cut me off. Number two is, what are your feelings? Frustrated, pissed off. I mean, you just write it all out. And then the final one is, talk yourself through and get yourself out of that. So I could get angry and worked up, or I could start making excuses for him and let it go. And the excuses could be, the guy had to go to the bathroom really bad. His wife's in the hospital. His mom's sick. His kid broke his arm at school and he's rushing to get him. And or, and this is a good one because it is more likely, that guy who cut me off is an absolute jerk. And that has nothing to do with me. He's going to then cut off the other guy and the other guy and the other guy. Would I advise all those people to go get that upset? No, I tell them, hey, let it go. You know, but when it's personal, we think it's us and we're not that big a deal. We got to get, talk ourselves down. And man, I've now got that on autopilot because I've been practicing it for 20 years. And that has been a tremendous help for me.
That's awesome. A lot of entrepreneurs get buried in entrepreneurship. They get lost in it. They lose themselves in it. They overwork. They burn themselves out. What did you learn in entrepreneurship, and how have you transcended? Maybe you experienced that and have transcended it. And how do you now counsel others to not get, not be married to the business, so to speak?
Yeah. So to be the best version of ourselves, I think we have to do a lot of good things. And a lot of those are eat properly, not eat a bunch of processed food, not drink alcohol, not drink soda, not eat a lot of sugar. But guess what happens when we're stressed and worn out? We crave those things. So I let myself go down those paths. I never got terribly overweight, but I did get out of shape. And I know it because I remember going to a picnic and we kicked the soccer ball around. And I remember being gassed. And I played soccer, football. I played baseball. I played all these sports all my life. And now a couple of years after all that, I was so out of shape. And it's because I was working so hard. But I didn't have the guidance. I didn't have any mentor. I didn't have anybody saying, look, it's important that you eat well. It's important that you exercise, that you sleep enough. Set an alarm the same time, 7 days a week to get yourself in a cycle. Nobody taught me any of these things that I do today. So I burned myself out. I got sick a lot. I remember going to trade shows four times a year in Las Vegas. And I remember, you know, those are monumental moments because they're big for me. I'd have to rent a big booth, pay a lot of money, hopefully get a lot of sales. If not, I lost money. And I have memories, not of the day to day, but I remember those trips and going to Vegas. And there were kind of markers in the calendar year after year after year. And I was always sick. And I remember looking back and thinking, I think the last 4 years that I've been here, that's 20 trips or 16 trips. I've been sick every time I've come, bad cold, sinus infection. That's what happens when you don't stop. I didn't even know what it meant to go get a massage. I didn't know what it meant to go spend a half hour in a sauna or in a jacuzzi or, you know, those things that really kind of reset your body, get the stress out. Now, how do I live my life? I have a cold plunge in my house. So I get there every morning and I get in very cold water, 5 to 8 degrees Celsius. I do hot tub, sauna, steam room. I exercise every day. I read books. Before, you know, you get in that mode and you just have to go, go, go. So what I really enjoy are business books, but mostly self-improvement books, is now you're doing internalizing and working through things. And also, here's another thing about your question. Entrepreneurship is a very, very lonely place. Mm-hmm. We are so alone because you're on your own. There's no coworkers. There's no one taking the responsibility. And it's all on you, good or bad. It's on you. But on top of that, something I found is a lot of men are lonely. We paint ourselves into a corner and we aren't as expressive as women. Women, you know, you see women, they see each other, they hug, they express, they cry. They're way better at expressing and getting that out. We just suffer internally. It's the reason, at least maybe similar in Canada, but in the United States, I think it's 77% of suicides are men. And the reason, part of the reason, I think, is because we bottle it all up and we don't build community. So now I not only join communities, I build communities and I help bring people together, which is helpful for me too and for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great, great advice. I'm just curious, was the shift in you to recognition of this an organic process over time, or did you have a kind of come to the J word moment where you kind of recognized, I have to change or I have to be different?
Yeah. You know, I love it. It's a great question. I think it was organic, but I'm sure if we looked at it on a radar, there'd be some blips where, this one thing happened where, you know, had a very stressful moment in the business and probably lost 6 months of my life in stress from it, and then maybe it washed itself out. You know, there are moments like that in entrepreneurship where I don't know what the data is, but I have a feeling that entrepreneurs might live a little bit less, some of them, the ones who don't master this, just because the level of stress and the amount of caffeine and food and just all that. For the most part, it was a continuing process. You know, something I do is journal, and I don't do it every day. I want it to be sustainable, so I do it every once in a while. But these are journals that I'm leaving for my kids for when I'm old. And they can take a day in the life or a month in the life of dad and see, okay, dad was 48 back then or 42 or 39. And they get to read what my day was like. And I say what's going on. And I talk about all four of the kids. And I talk about Jessica. And I say what's going on. Maybe not in the world because I haven't watched news in over 7 years. I honestly know nothing of what's going on in the world. All I care about is everyone around me. And that's what matters most to me. So what I'm talking about in there is I had some stress recently. This happened. And I'm so happy the kids did this, you know. So I want them to see that because I, you know, my dad tells me his stories today about when he was my age. But to be happy, to be able to have the gift of reading that in a document live as he was writing it when he was my age, I think that's a powerful tool. So I do that. And by doing that, I get something. I get to go backwards years from today, backwards. Mm. And I get to read where I was 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. And I go, huh, I was pretty dumb back then. I'm getting better, right? And I hope 8 years from now I read about today and I say, I was pretty dumb back then. So it's all gradual. There might be faster years and slower years. But I think if we're working on ourselves, we make progress over time, whether it happens immediately or slowly.
What did becoming a father teach you about yourself?
It got me, well, I had never really spent time with a baby. That was interesting because I had a nephew that I carried 5 times. That's it. I didn't have any younger brothers or sisters. I never cared for a baby. But it gave me, I guess, a huge sense of responsibility because up until that point, it was me worrying about becoming somewhat successful. Then it was, okay, I got a wife, but she's a great partner. She was a registered nurse all those years, and she worked really hard. So I didn't have to worry for her. She was fine. We were both just building. And now it's like, whoa, this is bigger. This is bigger than us. And that probably is the first time that I thought of like the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. Now, yes, I love my wife. Yes, I love my kids. But I worry about the rest of the world too. And I can't affect the whole world. That's why I don't watch the news, because if I can't fix it, I don't want the stress in my life. But I can hear that a friend or a friend's friend is going through something. And I tell them to call me. I'll talk for 25 minutes. I'll send you my calendar. We'll book a call, see if I can help. And that's probably the beginning of, oh, there's more than just me. And then there's more than just my wife and I. It's a kid. Oh, and if there's a kid, then another kid and 4 kids. And then there's a whole world out there that maybe we can help a little bit.
Right. What created the conversion for you from, you know, self-focus and creating things through entrepreneurship to outward focus of others and helping them move in a different direction?
Yeah. I think it happened when I got my first mentor, and he helped me to see things differently. And I remember I was young, I was in my 20s, and I thought, well, that's interesting. He's not getting anything out of this. He's just helping me because he's a nice guy. That's pretty neat. I hope one day I can do that. I remember thinking, oh, maybe I doubted it. I thought, who's going to ever want to hear my words? And now coaching clients pay me money to hear my words and talk things through it. So it's still, I still pinch myself from that. But it was that. It was, I think it was getting free help from people. And then I hired coaches and I paid them money. And I saw the impact they had on my life. And I said, I want to do this. That's what I'd rather do. That's why I sold my company. So I don't even have to, even though I wasn't in the day-to-day the last several years at all, I didn't even have an office anymore. I was just, but it would worry me. It was just tension and vendors. And so I let that go by selling it. And now I'm not as worried about the money. So I get to do what I really want to do for the next 50 years. And yeah, it's helping people. It's coaching entrepreneurs. It's helping men become better. It's helping my wife develop her program to now work with women and help them become better. And you know, it's funny. Sometimes it's self-limiting beliefs. I had a ton of them growing up where I grew up, not speaking the language when I was a kid. I thought I just wasn't worthy of a lot of things. And we all have that. Look, I occasionally will catch myself. Now I've gotten better and I go, no, I've done some things. I know things. I could learn. As my wife has been developing her women's program, that's going to accompany my program. She's a rock star. She was a registered nurse delivering babies for 10 years. Still has her license after all these years, but hasn't practiced anymore because we've got our own babies to worry about. She's a cancer survivor at 16 years old. She is the most disciplined person that I know. My wife will get up at, I don't care what time it is. We're on a trip. We drove from Miami to Niagara Falls, Canada, and spent 2 weeks along this beautiful trip. My wife was the first one up some days at 4 a.m. to get her 45-minute workout in the hotel room while we were all sleeping. And then she'd shower and wake us up and it was time to go. And she did that. She did that every day for 2 straight weeks. And that's just an example because you could say, well, you're on vacation. But yet, when I told my wife, this program. You're going to do so well. I know, I've seen you help people. You're going to build this so well. She'll have that self-limiting belief and she'll forget the rock star that she is. So I love being the one to just not say a word and just stare at her. When she's done talking, I go, are you kidding me? You know what you've done, the things you've accomplished, the things we built together. And then seeing that, like, yeah, you're right. Yeah. And then move forward. To me, that's worth a $1 billion.
Amazing. I have a book I always read to people on my podcast. It was a book I discovered years ago called The Day You Were Born. It's written by a New York lady by the name of Linda Joyce. It combines numerology with astrology. It kind of says what your purpose is. So you were born November 11th, you said, right?
Yeah.
Correct? Okay. So you're a Scorpio too. So your purpose is to experience your emotions, allowing the highs and lows to come and go so that you can gain confidence and control in your life without losing the passion. Scorpio twos struggle between wanting to be alone and wanting to communicate their feelings. Sometimes they are prolific writers or creative artists with a unique approach to life. Fantasy is strong. Scorpio twos have the power to visualize and manifest their vision in the now. The danger for them is becoming nostalgic about their past. They make good psychologists, healers, physicians. The pain and weakness of others affects them. They are strong and resilient. They have incredible courage, the kind that can make a difference in the world. Their life is full of drama. They're emotional, creative, and unique. If they conform too much, it can lead to depression and mood swings. If their emotions are blocked, they may struggle with a physical handicap or an unusual illness. They need faith in themselves and a higher power. Their attraction to the occult can lead to God or an insane guru. If they stay centered, their power and sense of compassion can be a great help to all who know them. Don't know if that resonates or not, but I always read it to people who are my guests. It's fun.
Yeah, great stuff. Can't conform, absolutely. And I think I've done okay staying centered for sure. And that's important to me. Yeah, a few of those things. Fantastic.
Last question. You found your passion. What is a word that describes your passion now?
That one word, you know, the businesses that I built were just to make money. I provided products to people that made them happy, but it didn't make me happy. You know, I didn't sell cups. I sold underwear, swimwear, athletic apparel. But if I sold you this cup and you love it, I guess that'll give you some serious value to your life. But as the supplier of those things, it did nothing for me other than build a business, gave me money, allowed my wife to stop working so we can build more kids, you know, more of a family and do these great things. But to me, I think it's meaning. Now there's meaning in my life. Mm. This is the reason I was here. So I want to share something with you, Scott. Yeah. When I came on that boat from Cuba when I was a kid, it was, you know, obviously the most meaningful moment in my life. It's really, you know, I could have gone this way. I ended up going that way. I could have grown up in a very poor country where I wouldn't be able to express my opinion or make more money than the government says. If it's $24 a month in US dollars, that's all I would make as a surgeon, right? If I was one. So I came to the United States and I got tremendous opportunities, but I have had something in my head every day since I was a little kid. I felt different. I felt that I was kind of here for a reason, but I didn't know how to vocalize that. I didn't know how to make it like a monument. So the only thing I have from my past life, from when I came from Cuba, is this. This is a shirt I wore on the boat when I came here. And I have pictures of me wearing this shirt right off the boat. Wow. And so this, I get to hold it. I get to smell it. I get to have this as my constant reminder. So I've got a walk-in closet. And when I go into my closet, this is the first thing. It's hanging just like this. And it's all that I see. I see that. And it's my reminder, number one, for gratitude. Because, man, am I grateful for the life that I've been able to live and have and the gift that I was given to be alive, but to be here. And then it's my reminder to make an impact. Because so many people died trying to do what I did to just get here. And so many first cousins of mine who I don't know. I just don't know them. I've never been able to visit them. By the way, if I go to Cuba, I will be arrested because I will speak my mind. And in the Cuban Constitution, I am their property because I was born there. So I cannot speak my mind and I will be treated like a Cuban citizen. If I spoke my mind, that's a couple of years in jail and it's not a nice jail. So I have not met those cousins. I don't know them. And I always think I'm doing this for them. I have these first cousins that are just like me, but they don't have these opportunities. So I'm here for a reason and I'm going to make it count.
That's a great way to finish that. That was kind of what I was trying to get to at the beginning around that immigrant experience that I think some people, that's the gift you can give to other people in the sense that I think some people, and I include myself in that because I was born and raised in Canada in a place where there is definitely struggle, but it's not the kind of struggle that somebody in Cuba, you know, encounters in their lives. And the fact that you actually have a relative understanding of that, even though you didn't live it, but you own it and you recognize it and it fuels you on a daily basis is, I think, a gift in some sense to you that allows you to transcend that and do the things that you've done in your life. So it's a great gift to the listeners as well.
Yeah. And even if someone doesn't have a story like mine, I think we should find elements of our own stories and find that piece where we can say, you know what, there was a transitional point. There was this, and hopefully ignite that spark in their life that they have a reason for being here. Just like I have my reason when I walk in my closet every day, I see it. Find what that is, because I think it'll give you that happiness, that gratefulness, and the sense of purpose to do bigger things in your life.
Awesome. To finish, is there, you know, anything you'd like the listener to know about what you're doing or, you know, what you've got going on or that you'd like to?
Sure. Yeah. I'll show you my book. If anybody's awesome. Looking at it, it's 31 Days to Become a Better Man. And the book is good. I think it's pretty good. But the program that I run is even more powerful. And it's on joelgandara.com. And it's 31 days. We go through it. I'm involved in the WhatsApp every day. We do a Zoom once a week. I record it for those who can't join. And at the end of the 31 days, it changes a man's life. And I say it on the website, if you do the exercises and your life doesn't improve and change, I will give you your money back. But just so you know, the whole money for 31 days is $199. And I'm in there actively helping. And I set you up with partners that are going to help you win. So, and that's it. There's no surprise catches after that. That and buying the book for $20. That's it.
Cool. Well, it was nice to meet you, Joel, and I appreciate your hour and inspiring story for people to listen to. So thanks for your time.
My pleasure, Scott.
Have a good day. Thanks for joining us today on Leave Your Mark. I hope we've left a mark on you today, and we wish only that you pay it forward by sharing this story, taking the time to rate and comment on this podcast. Please follow us at Twitter at Built by Scott and Instagram at King O'Payne and become a member of this community at Scott G. Livingston on Facebook. Have a great day. Music by Cedric de Saint-Rome.